Technological progress and automation is infiltrating and altering every facet of our lives, and the lives of our children, and soon their children, and their children's children. But in many ways, education and the current system of learning hasn't moved on very far from Edwardian times. Is it time for a new progressive era of education? But what will that look like, and where do values sit in this digital world? I'm Georgie Frost, and this is the So What from BCG.
If we get this right, education would become the great equalizer, and it would lift up the whole of society.
Today I'm talking to Dr. Leila Hotate, a specialist in human capital topics, and is the global lead of Boston Consulting Group's education, employment and welfare sector.
If you look at drawings of education classrooms at universities centuries ago, and you look at universities or classrooms today, they look very similar. It's very much teacher-centric, people sitting in rows and looking at the teacher and listening to the teacher. So very much true. Now we see so much change happening very fast, led by technology, by other trends, and education has to innovate, has to catch up. And I think it is going to start to happen at a very fast pace.
What will that look like? You said it needs to innovate, it needs to change. And it is strange that it's one of those areas in which it really hasn't, and yet it is so fundamentally important to communities, to society, to the world.
So if we want to ensure that we continue to fulfill our potential as humans in this unprecedented change era, and that we continue to pursue purposeful life, education and learning will have to change in a number of ways. There are three key themes that I think we need to see education change in. The first one is we need to make sure that we armor ourselves with the right skills for this fast-changing world. The second one is befriending technology. So technology is not the enemy. How do we befriend technology so that we can use it as a tool for equity and progress, and we mitigate the risks that come with technology? And the third one is lifting each other up and working towards better social equity through education and learning.
To achieve those three points then, the right skills, befriending technology, lifting each other up, as you say, what levers do you think we need to activate?
So if we think about the first point around making sure that we armor ourselves with the right skills, when I think about education, it's key to prepare people to unlock their true potential. And when we talk about education, or certainly when I talk about education, I'm not thinking classroom and campuses. I'm thinking very broadly about education and learning inside and outside the walls of education institutions and across all age groups, children, but also adults. It's all about lifelong learning today.
How do those two things marry up? When you talk about the way you think about education, inside classrooms and campuses and outside, do you see there's a time when there is no space for classrooms? It's all going to be done remotely outside.
I think education will happen soon everywhere. It will be seamless. Some experts call it invisible because it will be part of life everywhere, whether in the metaverse, in the classroom, in a campus, outside, as a part of a structured piece of a degree of qualification or very unstructured. Education will be ubiquitous. And so we need to make sure that we are in charge, or the educators are in charge of that, so it's the right things that we are teaching and learning.
So you've spoken about where learning happens, but what about the type of learning? There's so much focus now, isn't there, on coding and technical skills, but what about the so-called softer skills, the values, those sorts of things that we tend not to emphasize so much with education, and yet, I mean, maybe I'm wrong here, but seem to be more important in society than ever.
Absolutely. So when we talk about the future of work and the future skills that you will need to be able to work in the future, you hear a lot about STEM skills, you hear a lot about the importance of teaching coding and things of the sort. And while it is important to teach technical skills and for our kids to have technical skills, with technological advancement, what we're witnessing is by the time our kids graduate, the skills that they've learned are already obsolete. On top of that, what you see is that most fields of work are becoming increasingly intersectional. So there's no domain of knowledge that is standalone today. We need to stop asking our kids what they want to do in the future. We need to start asking them what problems they want to solve. And so to your point, social emotional skills, or sometimes we call them higher order skills, and it's skills like empathy, curiosity, grit, emotional regulation are becoming incredibly important, right? They differentiate us from the machines, so they are becoming incredibly important in the world of tomorrow. And if I take just a single example, the Stanford Marshmallow Experiment. So in this study, a child is given a choice between either one small but immediate marshmallow that he or she can have now immediately, or two marshmallow rewards if they wait for a certain period. So this is all about a skill called delayed gratification. Are you able to wait to get more? And what was found is that the children who were able to wait for a longer period tended to have much better life outcomes. So whether on educational attainment, but even in other life measures. So how do you make sure that you teach at a very early stage in life such skills such as delayed gratification? Another example, when we talk about social emotional skills, if you look at existing jobs today, like the job of being a doctor. Today, the physician is supposed to be the single source of truth on everything to do with your body, with your health. And that's what makes a good doctor mostly. It's about how good he or she is in terms of really understanding human biology and on all things to do with healthcare. But tomorrow, you know, Gates was talking just the other day that you'll have an electronic tattoo on you that will be capturing all of your healthcare data 24/7, and you'll have machines telling you all the diagnostics. So as a patient, you'll be extremely well informed. And the doctor then, the good doctor, will become the one who has the emotional intelligence to be your thought partner, your emotional partner, and make decisions with you about your health. So we see that these socio-emotional skills are becoming much more important than other skills. And we need to find ways to ensure that they are part of the education, of the curriculum. What we see is that these skills are becoming incredibly important to be successful in life and to contribute to society. We look at employers and they're looking for workers who have very strong skills such as resilience and professionalism. And they often report shortage of such skills more than they do on technical skills. On the other hand, when you see employees are also looking for more empathetic and more collaborative employers. And now you see a whole great resignation phenomenon because of that exactly.
I want to go back to the marshmallow experiment because I'm not sure how much it was taken into consideration the background of those children, the environment they grew up in, the support of their parents, their education level before they did the experiment. But do you think that the current framework for our education system supports skills that perhaps aren't technical, but no less important in our future?
This is a very good question, Georgie, and it's about the nature versus nurture debate. When I was younger, I used to think about school choices for my kids, and I used to think I really want a school that's very strong in mathematics, very strong in science and in languages and everything, all these core subjects and literacy where they have to be very academically rigorous. And now I really think very differently about the choice of school and what's important in terms of the skills that the education institution has to incorporate. Do I think in general we do enough, even from the youngest age in terms of parenting techniques, but then in education institutions, kindergarten and schools? Do we do enough? No, but certainly good schools are evolving to really incorporate these skills and in their curricula.
Where then do values and principles sit when we're progressing so much, when automation is inevitably going to come into education? You're going to have what you were talking about earlier, perhaps not that classroom structure in which these values and principles can develop. So how do they sit, do you think, in the future of education?
I think they need to be incorporated across the curriculum. So I'll give you a simple example. If it's a language class, it's very young kids, and we're reading to them and discussing with them Little Red Riding Hood, a simple story like Little Red Riding Hood. But in this time, instead of just telling the story and it's black and white and there's a good person and a bad person in the story, the teacher would try to show it or to discuss from the perspective of the wolf, and try to ask the students why the wolf might have acted the way that he has. You know, maybe he was hungry, and that if he was hungry, what would you do instead? What should the little girl do instead? Maybe she should just get him some food and he would have reacted differently. And it might sound like a very funny example, but this teaches kids critical thinking. It teaches them empathy. It teaches them how to control emotions, to think of better solutions. And we can see in the world today how important these skills are for a better world.
How would you measure that? Is it important to measure it?
So measurement is extremely important. And, you know, I remember in a class, in an MBA class, one of the first things we were taught were you get what you measure. So if you really want to get an outcome in education or you get an outcome at work, you have to be able to measure it. So being able to measure these skills also gives a signal that these skills are important. And you look at all the organizations that do standardized tests, international standardized tests like PISA. They are trying more and more to measure skills like collaboration, so collaborative problem solving, creative thinking, etc. But when it comes to these empathy, curiosity, and all these very value and character skills, it gets harder and harder. And you just base it on, you know, teacher or peer reporting, situational judgment tests like this of experiment of the marshmallow. There's still a long way to go in measuring these skills, but I think it's a place where we really need to invest, because the more we find creative ways and strong ways to measure, the more we'll be able to develop those fundamental skills.
Where did you go to school? I'm talking secondary and primary school.
I grew up in Lebanon during the war, and I went to a French lycée, and then I left Lebanon at 18.
Very different to me. I was born and raised in Norway before moving to school in the UK. I ask you this because in conversations around, you know, values and principles, and inevitably the future of education will turn to a universal framework for education. Is it possible to even have it? Is it possible to have it when we have such differing values and principles?
There's a lot of organizations that have tried, have put a lot of effort into trying to, you know, develop a single universal framework for skills.
What would be the benefit of that, though? What is the benefit of having a universal framework? Before we even look into whether it's possible, why would it be a good idea?
The benefit of having a universal framework would, you know, when you think about global citizens, when you think also about you know, machines and the need to provide the machines with our set of values so that they can make the decisions that we want them to make as humans, we need to all agree on what are the right values. We need to all agree what skills are important, etc., so that we can all advance education towards the same image of what is a global citizen, and so we can control technology versus technology controlling us. So these are just at a very quick, very high level, the important benefits of having a single universal framework for skills. And so organizations like the World Economic Forum, like OECD, have tried to do that and to standardize. And to some extent, you can try to converge and agree on some specific set of skills. But there are some where you would start to disagree at a cultural level on very basic things where we'd be quite surprised. I'll take one example. If you ask me about one of the key skills that I would like my children to have, that would be, and that most people would like their children to have, that would be curiosity, so that you can, you know, explore and investigate and learn. And then when you look at certain cultures like Japan, for example, they ascribe less value than we would to unstructured curiosity, and they would put much more respect and much more learning from the experience of the elderly. So it's very difficult to get to a single universal framework of skills and of values, because there are a lot of cultural differences.
And actually listening to both of those points, both have great merit, you know, respecting your elders and being curious. It would be a shame to try and, because you would inevitably have to prune some things out to have a universal system that actually, could we work in another way, a hybrid system that we can still have some kind of universality, but we're still keeping those, you know, amazing qualities that each culture and society brings?
We should definitely, try to work to converge and respect and celebrate the differences and incorporate that into what makes a global citizen. At the end of the day, a global citizen is one that also is very in tune with cultural differences and very tolerant of cultural differences. Where we would need some form of decisions, if you will, are when you come to, for example, you know, the need to control technology, as I was saying. So I'll give you a simple example. When you think of the example of the trolley problem, which I'm sure a lot of us are familiar with, but instead of a trolley, you think about the driverless car. And a simple example, if you think this car can either hit a child or an elderly, what would you choose if you could code the car? The Japanese people might decide that the elderly can then teach and share their experiences with many more, with every old person with 100 children. Whereas in other cultures, you might think he or she has his whole life ahead of him. So in this situation, we would need to try to come up and converge to a set of values, because we need to control technology before technology controls us.
You said at the start, befriend technology for progress and mitigating its risks. Tell me more about that.
Let me start with the befriending part that you mentioned. Technology has and continues to solve many societal problems. It's a key enabler if you want to deliver innovative education. So One example we're seeing is more of the use of artificial intelligence to deliver personalized learning, learning that is customized to the need of every single student. And today we're even talking about hyper-personalization in education, where you're really personalizing to every single aspect of a child.
How does that work? What would that look like? Children are developing and changing all the time. It's the beautiful nature of childhood. You'd have AI that can adapt with that child?
Yes. Children change, but technology is also very adaptive. So whether it's AI and also you see genetics, brain science, technology more generally, all of these fields are intersecting and will be adding a lot of value to education. So a simple example, there's a lot of research and scientific experiments to support autistic children in learning better by measuring their attention through various devices that they place on the to measure how the eyes are focusing or not. This same technology can be used with a larger population to see whether the individual is attentive, whether they require additional support to grasp a concept, to measure the cognitive load and see how much that child can understand at this point in time and what factors are affecting his or her absorption of learning. So the number of hours of sleep, etc. And you can imagine optimizing all of that and mapping content that he or she is learning to your cognitive development levels. Genetic testing can also be used to see to explore the student genetics and understand how best they learn. So you can imagine how science can go extremely far to create this super child, superhuman. Now, how much of that do we want is also a big question. Does this become the equivalent of the performance-enhancing drugs in sports? So where do we draw the line? Those are all ethical questions that need to be paused and agreed on universally by everyone so that education moves in the right direction.
Glad you mentioned that, because I was going to talk about, as a parent yourself, just looking at the risks at the moment that being online and being in a digital world for children pose, online bullying, and we can go very dark and very deep, troubling for a parent. How can you mitigate the risk? It's one of the eternal questions, isn't it? How can we get the most out of technology and the advancements, because they've transformed our lives in many wonderful ways, but there's always hanging, as I said, those dark, deep risks.
There are indeed these dark, deep risks, and we need to change our education systems in a way that teaches kids how to navigate technology, how to protect them from online bullying, from inappropriate content, from digital addiction. There's all these digital competencies that our schools are starting to teach the kids. They tell them how to behave online, what to share, what not to share online, etc. The solution cannot simply be on the children, obviously. Parents have to play a role, but also other actors. There's currently a generational digital divide where parents don't know how to educate their kids on safe practices regarding the use of technology because they grew up in a very different world. And beyond parents, there's a whole ecosystem that needs to be activated to protect children online, including the tech companies, law enforcement, child support services, the schools, obviously, and international agencies. So this is a very urgent and critical issue that needs to be addressed head on.
I know that people get kind of nervous when we talk about business involvement in schools and education, but do you see a positive role?
I think the role of businesses is critical in making sure that education evolves in the right direction. Innovative, for sure, but also preserving the right values. So whether it is to make sure that children online are kept safe, the role of business is extremely important there. Whether it is to make sure that we don't stretch too far when we think about augmented intelligence, etc., that we are still keeping our humanity and are doing the right things, whether we are developing education in the metaverse and we need to make sure that the developers there and the businesses there are working closely with educators to ensure that the education that's going to happen in the metaverse is the right one. These are just three examples of where we need to make sure businesses play the right role to ensure education evolves in the right direction.
Before we end the podcast, I want to go back to the start, if that's all right, when you spoke about what we can do to thrive and your third point, and I like this because I think it's quite a nice, hopefully uplifting end to the podcast when we've spoken about perhaps some of the troubles that lay ahead, but you said it could lift each other up working towards a better social equity. Talk to me about that.
So this is where education can be a great equalizer, if you may, and technology is a great enabler to this. When we think about access to internet or access to data, it's now viewed as a basic human right. So when we look at refugees, for example, and we think about access to water, access to food, making sure that they are safe, now we also say access to data and access to internet is the basic human right. Because with access to data, you have access mm-hmm. to education, to knowledge, but also later to jobs, to healthcare, to social services. And we recently worked on a paper on bridging the digital divide in the US. Basically, what the conclusion is, with full digital connectivity and permanently closing the digital divide, this is critical not only to achieve educational equity, but also to accomplishing all sorts of endeavors to promote equitable economic and social opportunities. So imagine if anyone from any social background gets access to the metaverse and learns from anything from the most famous and world-renowned teachers in the world. If we get this right, education would become the great equalizer and it would lift up the whole of society.
What a lovely point to end on. Leila, thank you so much. And to you for listening. We'd love to know your thoughts. To get in contact, leave us a message at thesowhat@bcg.com. And if you like this podcast, why not hit subscribe and leave a rating wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.